Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good to see you all on this beautiful 1 month early spring day. It's kind of amazing. But it's lovely to have a beautiful day for this day where all over the world, Buddhist in Buddhist temples and in little storefront zendos like this, people are gathering to commemorate the death of the Buddha, something like 2,500 years ago. That's pretty remarkable. One of the greatest spiritual teachers the world has ever seen died at the age of 80. An old man, a human being. His name at birth, the name he was given at birth, was Siddhartha Gautama, but he came to be known as Shakyamuni Buddha, the awakened one of the Shakya clan. Shakyamuni means sage of the Shakyas, the Shakya clan. The Buddha's death is called Parinirvana in the sutras, which means final nirvana, final enlightenment. The traditional belief being that ordinary deluded beings like us, after death, enter a transitional state. You've heard of the Tibetan bardo states, a transitional state before taking rebirth or being reincarnated in another form on one of the six realms on the wheel of life. The wheel of life and death, the hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, the human realm, the angry titan realm, and the heavenly realm. And that's a whole talk in itself to tell about those different realms. But they're very powerful archetypes, whether we take them literally or not. And in that traditional schema, a fully enlightened Buddha would not be reborn, but would step off the wheel. And in fact, if you see the Tibetan tankas showing the wheel, you see the Buddha up in one of the corners on a cloud, typically, and remain in a state of nirvana. Nirvana being a state free of all clinging and aversion, all separation of self and other, a mind of unbounded pure consciousness. And samsara, typically the opposite of nirvana, would be the state of delusion and suffering here in our human world. Now, in Zen, you don't hear a whole lot about reincarnation, unless it's to question, who is it that's reincarnated? And Zen tends to see nirvana and samsara as right here and now, separated only by a hair's breadth. A hair's breadth, a moment's lapse in awakening, which, of course, happens all the time in our daily life, those moments, or sometimes longer lapses. There's the old story of the Zen master who was confronted one day at the door of his temple by an arrogant samurai, saying, "If you're such a great Zen master, tell me the difference between heaven and earth." And the Zen master said, "Well, any idiot knows that. You don't need me to tell you that." At which the samurai was enraged, drew his sword, raised his sword, and the Zen master was saying, "That's hell." And the samurai stopped short, lowered his sword, and the Zen master said, "That's heaven." The samurai smiled. So in keeping with this here and now everydayness of our practice, what I want to talk about today and what I find most moving about the story of the Buddha's death is not his final enlightenment so much as how he spent the final year of his life, his last days and months, and how he's helped the Sangha prepare for his death. This story to me is deeply human and gives us an opportunity to reflect on the impermanence of our own lives and to learn from the Buddha's example. Remember that when the Buddha was still Siddhartha, his first encounters with sickness, old age, and death as a young man were what set him on the path to find a way to be awake and at peace in this world. You don't need me to remind you of all the ways our culture conditions us to turn away from those realities. We seem to take sickness, old age, and death as a personal affront. Who, me? Why me? Or who, you know, my loved one? Why my loved one? And yet our practice asks us to look deeper. How can we practice turning towards illness, aging, and death with mindful presence, with compassion, and patience? How can we face the impermanence of everyone and everything that we love? Last year we started a series of gatherings called Perspectives on Death, Dying, Buddhist Perspectives on Death, Dying, and Loss, to create a kind of space for people to come together in community to consider these very questions. And we're going to be continuing that series in the coming months in various ways. But for today, let's look at how the Buddha faced his own impending death. In his 80th year, after wandering and teaching for 50 years, the Buddha had just finished a retreat and was sitting warming himself in the sun. His faithful attendant Ananda came and started to give him a leg and foot massage, which is really nice when you're old and your feet are, you know, and your legs are kind of sore. My mom, who's 91, and just had to move into a nursing care unit from her independent living place, was quite amazed at how nice those foot massages feel. And Ananda said to the Buddha, "This is amazing. The color of your skin is no longer clear and bright. All your limbs are flaccid and wrinkled. Your body is bent forward, and there seems a change in the sense faculties of your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and bodily sensation." The Buddha answered, "So it is, Ananda. The color of my skin is no longer clear and bright. All my limbs are flaccid and wrinkled. My body is bent forward, and there seems a change in the sense faculties of my eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and bodily sensations." Felt like that's kind of the conversation I was having with my mom when I visited over Christmas. All those things were so evident. And at her door, she has a room in this nursing care unit, is a little glass case. And in the glass, and each of the 12 people in that unit has one. And there are photographs. There's a photograph of her, a recent photograph, and a photograph of her when she's probably 20. And she's wearing her little tennis skirt, and she looks absolutely vibrant. How did that young woman turn into this bent, frail, old woman? The Buddha had no illusions that he was aging. He readily acknowledged. How many of you have noticed a few of those signs? Some more than others. How do you feel when you notice those signs? And you look in the mirror and, What is that? Can we notice our aging, changing bodies without denial, without judgment, without aversion, maybe a little, but with equanimity, even gratitude for the life we've had and the body we have and its faculties such as they are? I felt with my mom a gratitude for the humor that she still has over her situation. Sometimes she was pretty grumpy about it as well, but the humor is still there. Even though the mind is going, the humor is still there. How do we really appreciate what we still have? Well, the Buddha continued to do what he had done for 50 years, and that was to travel from place to place, visiting his many followers, kings and beggars, monks and nuns, lay men and women, and wherever he went, he taught the Dharma. But it seems as though he made a special effort that last year to review and remind his disciples of his core teachings. These teachings were the Buddha's gift to the world. He did not hold back. He offered them freely. So we might ask ourselves, what is our gift to the world? Of course we're not Buddhas, but we're all bodhisattvas in training. And so we need to ask ourselves, what is it? What is it that you love to do? What will you do until you are no longer able? What is your particular offering to the world? However modest. Your expression of the Dharma. And I don't mean you have to preach the Dharma. The authentic expression of our particular gifts is our Dharma when we offer it up. Another thing the Buddha did in the months before he died was to leave words of encouragement and advice to his Sangha. At one point he asked Ananda to summon all the monks and the nuns to the area where he was staying, and he delivered to them a long and comprehensive list of ways in which a community can prosper and not decline. And in this list are things that any human social organization might do well to follow. Here's just a partial list. Some of the admonishments are a little maybe outdated, but these are the ones that I thought were really, really good for all of us. Have frequent and well-attended meetings. Avoid taking pleasure in being busy, gossiping, sleeping, and socializing. These little socializings, right? Maintain both publicly and privately bodily, verbal, and mental acts of loving kindness. Be impartial and indiscriminate sharers with the Sangha of what is lawfully gained, even what is received in the begging bowl. And maintain the seven factors of enlightenment: mindfulness, investigation of mental states, energy, happiness, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. We could do worse. So what words of encouragement would you leave to those you love? To your children, your spouse, your friends? Do you have to wait till your deathbed to say those words? Maybe we could say them in advance, now and then. So several months before his death, the Buddha was very sick with what sounds like a severe attack of dysentery. I'm going to read you this passage because it's a very important one. After the Blessed One had taken up residence for the rains, a severe sickness attacked him with violent and deadly pains. He bore them without complaint, mindful and fully aware. Then he thought, "It is not right for me to attain final nirvana without having addressed my attendants and taken leave of the Sangha. Suppose I forcibly suppress this illness by prolonging the will to live." He did so, and then the sickness abated. People actually do that sometimes. Having, in my years of working in hospice, there would be times that people who were really, really ill would wait until some special graduation or wedding had happened and then let go of their lives. Sometimes. The Buddha recovered from that sickness. Soon afterwards, he came out of the sick room and sat on a seat made ready at the back of the dwelling. The Venerable Ananda went to him and said, "I have been used to seeing the Blessed One." He always talks to the Buddha, refers to the Buddha in the third person. You can't say you. It's kind of rude. "In comfort, I've been used to seeing the Blessed One in comfort and in health. Indeed, with the Blessed One's sickness, I felt as if my body were quite rigid. I could not see straight. My ideas were all unclear." Have you ever felt like that when you first heard of a loved one's terminal diagnosis? Something like that? That feeling of, couldn't see straight. The body felt quite rigid. My eyes, my ideas were all unclear. "However, I comforted myself knowing that the Blessed One would not attain final nirvana without a pronouncement about the Sangha of bhikkhus." Bhikkhus are the monks. Then the Buddha replies, "But Ananda, what does the Sangha expect of me? The Dharma I have taught has no secret and public versions. There is no teacher's closed fist about good things here." He said, "You know, I haven't held back. Now I am old, Ananda. My years have turned 80. Just as an old cart is made to carry on with the help of makeshifts, so too, it seems to me, my body is made to carry on with the help of makeshifts. For my body is only at ease when, with non-attention to all signs and with cessation of certain kinds of feeling, I enter upon and dwell in the signless heart deliverance." What he's saying here is he's only comfortable if he's in a very, very kind of refined state of concentration. His body is breaking down. "So Ananda, each of you should make yourself a lamp, yourself and no other your refuge. Each of you should make the Dhamma a lamp, the Dhamma and no other your refuge." How does a bhikkhu do that? And then he gives once again his teaching of the four foundations of mindfulness: mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mental objects, and mindfulness of consciousness. That is how we take refuge. You may have heard this passage, sometimes translated as "make of yourself an island." Have you ever heard that? Apparently, the Pali word in the original text can be translated either as island or as lamp. And I've chosen lamp because island suggests a kind of isolation. I mean, we can't tell which the Buddha meant, but using the word lamp suggests that each of us has the light of the Dharma within us, so we can never be lost from it. And maybe even if it is island, if he meant island. Maybe he meant island in the sense of a refuge, a protected place. So we take refuge in the Dhamma. You're hearing me say Dhamma and Dharma. Dhamma is the early language Pali that the earliest texts were written in, and Dharma is Sanskrit. So if you hear both, don't worry about it. So the Buddha was so generous, so careful, you know, to encourage the Sangha. Not long after that illness, the Buddha was visited by Mara, the demon of temptation and doubt. And Mara urged him to go ahead and attain final nirvana. In other words, go ahead and die. He was saying, in effect, you're tired, you've done enough. The Sangha will be fine. It's time for you to step off the wheel of karma and be free. But again, the Buddha replied that he would not die until he deemed that the Sangha was mature and steady in their practice and ready to continue on and teach others. So at that point, he announces that he will live for 3 more months and then deliberately let go of his life. So there's that temptation, and we have to look at that carefully, that temptation to kind of give up on this life. And again, the Buddha was very scrupulous about how he faced that. And I find that really moving, that even the Buddha felt that temptation, that doubt. That was, you know, he had his moment of doubt even that late in his life. So his final illness did come 3 months later. It seems to have been a case of food poisoning. The Buddha and the Sangha were invited to dinner by the son of a goldsmith named Kunda. Much delicious food was served, including something that's translated as hog's mincemeat. But literally, it's sweet pig. So there's been much scholarly debate about what this food actually was, whether it was pork or bamboo shoots that grow in places trampled by pigs, or a kind of mushroom that grows in places that are trampled by pigs. I mean, the mushroom is a good speculation, I think. But we don't know. At any rate, what's important to note is the Buddha gave instructions that this dish not be served to anyone but himself. And that after he became deathly ill from eating it, he made certain to instruct Ananda in what to say to anyone who tried to place blame on Kunda for causing the death of the Buddha. I mean, how would you feel? But the Buddha said Kunda should be praised for his generosity, and that this meal received before his death or his final enlightenment was just as important as the one he received before his enlightenment 50 years before. He received a meal of probably something like rice pudding from a milkmaid when he had been starving himself in doing a very fierce ascetic practice, and he finally made the decision to take nourishment. So he's saying this meal was just as important. So this story brings to mind how strongly we're inclined to blame in cases of accident, illness, death, how difficult it is to see the true complex links of cause and effect that converge in a particular illness or death or accident. When something out of our control has happened, we want to grasp at someone or something to blame. Or ourselves. Often we're quick to blame ourselves. Even after it's all over and after the person has died, grasping at blame can be a way of hanging on. So this is another way we can practice with illness and aging and death, by applying kindness and mindful awareness to that tendency that can arise in us and loosening our grip on that control stick of our lives, developing compassion for human vulnerability. Even during his final illness, the Buddha tried to travel further with his Sangha, but he became too weak to continue, and he lay down in a grove of sala trees. And that's what this image is of the Buddha with the Sangha, and there are a lot of heavenly deities there amongst the Sangha as well. And then what I love is all the creatures, all the animals as well. You might want to take a look at this later. And even then, oh yeah, and there's another picture in the kitchen you can look at, a smaller one. These scrolls you see in temples in Japan, and Michael and I used to live near a big Zen temple that had a huge, big, old wooden hall, probably three stories high, with this scroll. This is this very one, or this reproduction, which is huge. It's probably the rolled up, it's about this big, and then it's dropped down, it's about three stories. This is huge. And it's only displayed once a year on this day. So we used to go see it. And we had another copy, which we got about halfway through coloring in with colored pencils. And then the cat attacked it. But I'm glad we still have this one. So this is the final scene, the classic scene of the Buddha. When you see the image of the reclining Buddha, that's what it's representing, the Buddha on his deathbed. But even as he lay on his deathbed, he continued to take further steps to prepare the Sangha for his death. He did not neglect practical matters. And in a wonderful passage, Ananda asks him three questions. First, he says that when during the rainy season, the Buddha would go into retreat, and Sangha members from around different parts of the country would come and receive teachings and be inspired by his presence. So Ananda asks, what should they do now after the Buddha's gone? And the Buddha instructs him to encourage the Sangha to make pilgrimages to the places where the Buddha was born, where he was enlightened, where he gave his first teaching, and where he died. And that's something that Buddhist practitioners do to this day in India, make pilgrimages to those sites. And then Ananda asks, Lord, how are we to treat women? Now keep in mind that it was Ananda who intervened on behalf of the women who asked to join the Sangha. The Buddha initially refused, but Ananda challenged the Buddha and asked, are women just as capable of enlightenment as men? And the Buddha had to agree. So he relented and consented to admitting women into the Sangha, in a culture where that was a pretty radical thing to do. So when Ananda asked, how are we to treat women? The Buddha answers, do not see them, Ananda. Just don't look at them. But Ananda persists, that's not good enough. He said, if they are seen, how should we treat them? Do not address them, Ananda, the Buddha replies. But Ananda is still not satisfied. He knows the power of sexuality, and perhaps even more the need we have to connect, to see and be seen, to speak and be heard. So he asks, Lord, if we do address them, how should we treat them? And the Buddha replies, mindfulness should be maintained, Ananda. I really like this passage a lot because it shows Ananda being teacher to his teacher. Patiently insisting to the Buddha. The Buddha kind of, he doesn't really want to deal with this question. But Ananda's saying, yes, tell me how to deal with this. The sticky question of gender and sexuality. Just saying don't look and don't speak is not good enough. That's not a good enough answer. Only by being mindful of body, feelings, thoughts, and actions can we conduct ourselves in respectful and caring ways when it comes to gender and sexuality. We're still working on it, 2.5 millennia later, right? So the next question Ananda asks is how the Buddha's remains should be treated. And the Buddha gives detailed instructions for the preparation and wrapping of his body, the making of the funeral pyre, and the construction of a monument where his remains can be interred. So how many of us have put in writing what we would like to be done with our remains? You don't have to raise your hands. But it's so easy to see our death as something in the distant future and to procrastinate about things like making a will, stating what we want done with our property, our wishes in terms of whether we want cremation or burial, any wishes for our funeral, and what about instructions about what we would want if we were unable to make our own healthcare decisions. All of this forethought is a gift to those who will have to deal with the aftermath of our death. As any of you know who have had to take that responsibility in your family. So the Buddha did not neglect the practical aspects of his impending death. You know, that's pretty impressive. He showed his love for his Sangha most beautifully, though, in the way he entrusted the practice to them. You know, he just gave it over to them. Even in his final illness, he ordained one last disciple, a man named Subhadda, who just showed up wanting to see the Buddha, having heard of his illness. Ananda tried to turn him away. You know, wouldn't you be protective if you were Ananda? Don't bother him now. But the Buddha insisted on receiving this man. And after ordaining Subhadda, the Buddha turned to Ananda and said, "You may think the word of the teacher is a thing of the past. Now we have no more teacher. But you should not regard it so. The Dhamma and the discipline taught by me and laid down for you are your teacher after I am gone." In the end, the Buddha called the Sangha together and asked if they had any last questions for him, and they didn't. Then he declared, "It is the nature of all formations to dissolve, attain perfection through diligence." So that means all manifestations in this world change and dissolve, come into being and pass. And then he said, "Continue with your practice." And those were his last words. He then entered progressive states of meditative concentration and died. There was a great earthquake, followed by the recitation of verses by several of his disciples, as well as various deities present. The texts say that among those present, both human and deities, there were those who lamented and wept, and those who were aware that all conditioned existence is impermanent and subject to dissolution. And those, so you can see in the pictures, there are those who are weeping and lamenting, and then others are very peaceful. So the story of the Buddha's last month gives us quite a few ways to consider how we might face the inevitable loss of our own lives or the lives of those we love. Not turning away from aging, not waiting to offer our particular gifts to the world, saying what we need to say to those we love and care about, taking care of practical concerns, before we die, and most fundamentally, practicing moment to moment mindfulness of body, sensations, perceptions, feelings, thoughts, deeply trusting the light of the Dharma within us. Being a lamp unto ourselves, we are a lamp unto others. The Buddha's last teaching to his Sangha and to us was the gift of his death, of his humanity. So what we'll do now is a simple ceremony of light to express our gratitude for his life and teachings and death. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for listening.
Here's three.